You're listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Here with a fresh perspective on the market, the economy, and your money. From the Spokane office of the Opus 111 Group, Mike Mayle.
Thank you, sir. And welcome again to your antidote to conventional wisdom, where we give you a weekly review of the market and economy and what we like to think of as plain American, so you can better understand what's going on out there and make some hopefully informed decisions about what you're doing with your money. Now, we did yesterday close three of the indices, major indices, closed at all-time highs, one just within a fraction. So that ends up a pretty good week in that regard. Now, we'll also be talking just briefly about some of points that came out about the economy this past week, and then we'll go on into the market. What do you do when it's a high market? You know, which way do you jump, or do you? Perhaps give you some insight into what is usually the biggest problem in having a successful investment experience, I guess you could say. Just some other general comments on the markets and investing. And finally, I may, if we have time, wax poetic a little bit about gold. So let's get to the data dump. The Dow, which didn't quite make it to a new all-time high, just did establish one, recently on the 23rd of February. But in any case, the Dow closed the week at 39,087. That was up 90 points. The S&P did hit a new high at 5,137. NASDAQ also at a new high at 16,274. And yes, the Russell 2000, the small cap index, hit a new high at 2,076. 10-year Treasury ended the week at 4.18%. Crude closed at $79.97 a barrel. Soft white wheat continuing to move lower. I don't know why, but it is. It's at $5.86 a bushel. Gold settled the week at $2,092 an ounce, with silver closing at $23.36 an ounce. Now, in terms of coming attractions, next week is Jobs Week. Now, it isn't called that, and it's not like Shark Week by any stretch, but what it is, it's just a lot of data about the jobs market. For example, Wednesday we get the report on private payrolls. Also, we'll learn about job openings and what's called the JOLTS report. On Wednesday and Thursday, our close personal buddy, Mr. Jerome Powell, will be testifying in front of Congress. I don't envy him that job. The initial unemployment claims report is due out on Thursday, and on Friday, dun, 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 the February jobs report will be released. So we do have some data of note coming forward. So stay tuned. And segueing quickly into a few economic considerations, personal incomes, spending, have started the year on a positive note. From an inflation standpoint, the PCE prices, that stands for Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, that's what the Fed likes to use for their measure of inflation. Anyhow, those prices were up 0.3 in January, so the year-over-year number is now 2.4%. So that's trending closer to the magic 2% that the Fed says they want. Their core prices, and that takes out food and energy, was up 0.4 in January, up 2.8 year over year. And so we've got now changing gears. We go to new home sales. Started the year on a positive note, second month in a row on the upside. And while we could be perhaps past the worst of the headwinds for new home sales, they're still about 5% lower than they were last fall. U.S. economy did grow at a slower pace. Sorry, that wasn't a bad, that was a bad segue. I'm talking about the GDP now. The economy grew at a slightly slower pace than what had been anticipated or reported in the fourth quarter last year. This will be the first of three revisions. It accelerated at a 3.2% annual rate, and that's just 1/10 of a percentage point lesser than the original estimate. So no reason to perform bodily injury to yourself. It's hardly a difference. The GDP reports that, you know, this is something you need to understand about a lot of economic reports, and including this one. is that they're old news to stocks. In the case of GDP, that's the last quarter. And right now, we're 5 months from the start of that last quarter. So old news by any name is, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, do you make decisions based on it? Not really. You know, it's just, I think, gives us more evidence, though, that the private sector doing better than anticipated to some people. And it is showing surprise power persisting, even as investors are recalling that certain individuals were thumping the drum most of last year, saying, watch out for the recession. It's still missing in action, and for my way of looking at it, is still maintaining that position. Now, let us jump into some market commentary. As we mentioned, three of the four major market indicators have set all new all-time highs just in the last week. And if you go back to 2015, I've got a list of how many new highs were set. Recently, in 2023, we didn't have any. In 2022, we had one. But in 2021, we had 70. 2017, we had 62. 2019, we had 35. These are not unusual occurrences. As a matter of fact, over the last 10 years, we've had over 260 new highs hit in the marketplace. So no need to get all heavy breathing about the fact that we're hitting some new highs now. Now, you do recall, perhaps, that a bunch of your money got cut in half and perhaps a little more in 2007 and 2009. You also would have lost more than 19% in that 2018 correction, 34% in the bug-related crash, and 25% in that very short, who almost missed it, 2022 inflation bear market. Now, even if you had totally bad timing and bought at the top, right before it got cut in half and then some, your returns would still look pretty good over the long haul. Operative term, long haul. So what about investing at this current or any top? A strategist named Warren Pies, P-I-E-S, had some thoughts that I thought were good. He said, going back to 1954, markets are always higher 1 year after the high. Only exception was 2007, which I think we can call an outlier. And that was after housing had peaked, subprime mortgages were defaulting, and so on and so forth. And the world was ending as some people knew it. History also shows that the broader market averages still do well when market leaders peak and turn lower. Brian Belsky at BMO says, and I'm quoting, our analysis shows that the S&P has performed just fine following peaks in relative performance of the 10 largest stocks. The S&P has averaged a 14.3% return in the year following this prior relative performance peak since 1990. Only period where the index posted a loss was in 2001, aka tech bubble, and they, BMO, does not consider that to be a comparable period despite some recent chatter to the contrary, unquote. So, bottom line, as noted, we've had nearly 260 new highs over these past 10 years. The record after those has been generally good. There's not too much about the market today that's actually unusual relative to market history. See, you got to know history in order to understand that. And that reinforces the fact that the stock market usually goes up over the long term. For instance, from the market peak set just before the 2008-2009 crisis ripped your marketing face off, the S&P 500 is up over just 350% in total. So that translates to annual returns of about 9.5% a year, which is basically the long-term average over the past 100 years. So you did have to sit through and endure the flips and flops. And, of course, the best defense against significant losses in the market, very simple. You have to have a long enough time horizon. And just a couple stocks that have hit new highs, I mean, like from a long time ago. O'Reilly Auto is highest since 1993. This just happened this past week. Ross Stores, highest since 1985. TJX Companies, highest since 87. Costco, at its highest level since its IPO in 1985. American Express, high level since its IPO in 1977. MasterCard, highest since 2006, and Marsh & McLennan, all-time high going back to 1962 when it first became a public company. Pretty good stuff. I was reading a list of stocks that have just recently hit new highs, and it was longer. I mean, I could do a dramatic reading here and take up a whole segment almost. But I think it's important to understand that when you see stock prices, it isn't about where the earnings have been. Once again, that's history. But where are they going against what is priced into the shares right now? And that is evident within the present valuations. Now, these valuations of individual companies don't tell you a lot because stocks do price in expected earnings well ahead of the consensus, and they're really dang good at it. So that list of names and many of the other stocks that are making new highs are already anticipating the forward earnings growth. Perhaps a company you may be familiar with, at least recently, called NVIDIA, is a prime example of anticipating forward earnings growth. When you're the only game in town, it's pretty hard to say how high is up. So current valuations only reflect present thinking and market movement, not what earnings will actually do in reality. That gap between reality and expectations is what drives stock prices the most. Remember, earnings are what drive stock prices, bottom line. A little bit interest rates, but it's still mostly earnings. Now, if you use the P.E. ratio, that's the price-to-earnings ratio, to determine valuation, that can be a challenge to determine, you know, should I buy here or later, whatever. That's because P.E.s incorporate past prices. And past prices never, never predict. They will never tell you where stocks are headed. Fundamentally, longer-term direction of forward-looking markets depends on what isn't priced. So how earnings evolve over the next 3 to 30 months, the magic frame for stock market anticipation, is based on new incoming actual information versus present opinions. That's what will determine the stock's trend and changes along the way, notwithstanding. PEs aren't going to tell you when 6,000 will arrive for the S&P and when the next bear market will start or how much stocks earn between then and now. Sorry, it just doesn't work that way. Now I want to swing into something. I'm calling it perspective. I don't know exactly, but it gives you a kind of a broader view of things. In the New York Times opinion page, there was an op-ed on the 21st of February. And it was headlined, quoting, "Many Americans believe the economy is rigged," unquote. Now, I'm hoping that there are maybe two people listening to me today that actually believe that. Because you can't do it. I mean, you can't. You can try to influence it, but you rig it, no way. So two researchers reported the results of, I don't know how these guys got into it, but the American Academy of Arts and Sciences focus group survey of everyday Americans' perceptions. Now, I read that. I didn't make that up. They determined that the people surveyed, quote, "believe the rich and powerful have designed the economy to benefit themselves and have left others with too little or nothing at all," unquote. Those folks just can't seem to be able to reconcile the solid GDP growth and other economic growth with their daily experiences of having to deal with rising rent and food prices. Okay. Now, every one of us is absolutely sure, beyond any doubt, that if only we were in charge of the economy, there would be perpetual peace, love, doves, and incense with continually improving happiness and perpetually rising living standards for all, yea, verily. However, since for some reason we can't all seem to agree on how best to do that, and that's because we all disagree and everybody's imperfect and wrong about something, present company included, excluded, of course, the system will always be a whirling composite of competing worldviews and interests perpetuated by other folks. That means there will be winners and losers, and people who have vested interests in perpetuating those differences. No names, please. To achieve any meaningful rate of return, you have to take risk, okay? Write it down, get a tattoo, put it on your mirror. To get any meaningful rate of return, you must take risk. Now, that's relative, but it's just life, and there are always, always trade-offs. Warren Buffett said, and I'm quoting, risk comes from not knowing what you're doing, unquote. And there's a lot of that with individual investors, you know, kind of flailing around, listening to talking heads and just kind of picking up bits and pieces and perhaps not coming to the best conclusions. So, you know, stocks offer the highest long-term returns of all major asset classes. You can look it up. And if you sample long rolling time horizons, those returns tend to be less variable than other investments. However, as we perhaps have noted, in shorter periods, they can often swing pretty hard in both directions. Some people have decided to call that volatility. Now, that means to give you a chance of landing those long-term returns that you set out for yourself, you must accept the risk and high likelihood of some temporary declines. Now, temporary doesn't mean 10 minutes. You know, we can talk months, maybe even a couple of years sometimes, but they're temporary. And that is the operative time. Excuse me. And so investments that swing less in the short term, move around less in the short term, by contrast, have lower long-term returns because you're getting most of your return currently. There's very little growth going forward. Utilities are a typical example of that. Cash moves the least, but it has the lowest return. And once you factor in inflation, well, and taxes, it's basically almost a long-term money loser. It's been my experience that the vast majority of folks need some growth, which means that the vast majority of those folks have to be exposed to temporary declines in all or some of their portfolio's value. There's dangers in not seeing this correctly and instead maintaining the totally mistaken belief that you can, in fact, target capital preservation and growth at the same time. As we like to joke, double your money day after tomorrow at no risk. Can't be done, folks. No, it's a fact. It is a total fact that 11,000 people, as out there right now, are turning 65. And on an average day in 2024, that's going to continue throughout the year. About 4.1 million folks, the most ever, will be making the 65 team. And as those folks do head into their two-person, three-decade retirements, I think it's necessary to remind them, and those already retired or can see that retirement coming over the horizon, that it's not their account statements that they'll be taking to the store for purchases over those next 1,500 weeks or so of that retirement. It's their income. Now, Bob Carey, he's a great guy. He's from First Trust. He reports Bloomberg's finding that the S&P paid dividends of $70.91 last year. That's the index. That was up from $67.57 in 22 and $59.20 in 21. Bloomberg has an estimate as of the end of January that the S&P dividends will continue to rise to new record levels of $74.54 this year and $79.66 in 25. Now, those last two are estimates, okay? So they'll change. But assuming they end up being even reasonably accurate, that would mean that the S&P's cash dividend will have risen 35% over just 5 years. Now, see, that's the trade-off with fixed income. Fixed income, if you got a 5% deal, it isn't going to go up 35% over 5 years. It's going to pay you 5% for 5 years. End of story. Now, millions of words have been put out since the Fed engineered this interest rate rise. And it caused CDs and bonds to suddenly make sense to some because their stated yields went up. And as for the serious long-term investor who looks for real return, which is after factoring in taxes and inflation, these kinds of things never make sense. That's because, net of those factors, their returns remain negligible. other words, after tax and inflation, the returns on CDs and bonds tend to be almost no meaningful figure. Always been that way, probably always will be. If you're looking for real return, and that's after taxes and inflation, CDs, bonds, those kinds of things tend not to make much sense for people because, well, their returns are, as the quote was, negligible. You know, for the long run, I am convinced, and that's the operative term, that there's only one rational long-term investment goal, and it isn't growth, and it isn't income. It's kind of a little bit of each. It's the growth of your income over time. So in that regard, as we were talking about the S&P's dividends, the growth of that dividend, and it's been growing since 1980 at basically twice the CPI inflation rate. That's almost, most people don't even know that that's a thing. They're focused on interest from bonds, interest from CDs. They don't think about the dividends from the stock. So ignorance is definitely not bliss in this regard. Bob from First Trust, he reminds us that, and this again according to Bloomberg, that the dividends of the S&P have contributed over 37% of the total return. That's from 1927 through the end of last year. 37%, that's a significant chunk. So, you know, basically a third of your return, total return over all that period has been to dividends. And yet again, most people are like, no concept that that is even something to be aware of. And that should be much more important than whether or not the dang stock market is up or down today or this week or whenever. And based on the historical record, I believe that those dividends will continue to increase significantly faster than inflation eats away at your buying power. So that actually helps to improve your lifestyle as a retiree because it can grow the income without you having to do anything. I mean, they well hold the shares and you'll get an increase in the dividends whenever they decide to do so. You know, think of having a dividend growth focus as, if nothing else, a kind of financial blood pressure medication, okay? And I think that's kind of a good way to be looking at it. Now, in talking about investing in general, let me throw something out that you may even score points at your next cocktail party with this bit of information. The CGM Focus Fund. Anybody remember that one? Now, this was the best, the absolute number one, top of the rock, best performing mutual fund from 2000 to 2009. Its average annual investment return was 18.2%. Not too bad. Now, we're getting to what's called the investor return. Remember the difference? That's what the fund does and then what individuals get. Well, the investor return, and that's technically how they do it, is they take the average annual return earned by the average dollar invested over the entire period, was minus 11%. That's 29% difference. How do you do that? Well, there is never going to be a greater destroyer of your invested wealth than panic, and the one that's right behind that is performance chasing. That's what you saw there. This achievement in a flat to a down market is all the more amazing because this fund, the CGM fund, I mean, it totally blew away the second best performer by 3.5%. I mean, that's a lot. But you can't get upset at yourself for missing it because so did everyone else, including, and especially, those average shareholders during those 10 shoot-the-light-out years. See, because the average shareholder during that decade, based on their dollar-rated return, again, came up with 11% loss. Now, that's from Morningstar. I did not have a divine inspiration on this thing, you know. And unless you think this is impossible, here's how it might have happened. And actually, in point of fact, it did. In 2007, the all-time top of the equity market at the time, the Focus Fund returned a blazing 80%. Yo, 80, yeah. Whereupon the quote-unquote investors put $2.6 billion into the fund over the year, even as the fund was going down 48%. Investors, once again in quotes, had pulled out three-quarters of a bill by November of 2009. And if you look at the, not that this would make good reading, but the year's total net withdrawals, you can see how this works. Calling these people investors, I think, is like calling unemployment people who bought 100,000 trailers with those no income, no job kind of mortgages, homeowners. But in any case, you know, UBS Global Asset Management strategist Barry Mindenach said, "You should also assemble. You should always assemble a portfolio of the last 5 years of five-star rated mutual funds. That is, if your goal over the next 5 years is a two-star experience, because typically, if you're buying all these funds at their highs." Over that next few years, you can see them do as Mr. Mandich has suggested, see them underperform rather heavily as you get these performance chasers. You know, this kind of performance always brings in tons of crazy money, and it forces the purchase of most of the fund's assets at the worst possible prices. So that almost ensures that whatever is drawing in all that hot money must underperform, over the next chunk of time. Now, please understand this. There is no statistical evidence for the persistence of performance. None. Zero. And no advisor allows clients to chase performance. Well, no good advisor. And when you get drawn into a discussion of past performance, no, it doesn't mean anything predictive. As I said earlier, past PEs, past anything, past GDP, past what, doesn't indicate anything in terms of where your investments will go going forward. You know, the only alternative is to, well, stay away from the dang thing. You know, through December of 2009, the saga of the best performing fund of that decade proves one thing only. The dominant determinant of real-life long-term investment outcomes isn't investment performance. It's not the manager. It's not the market. It's your behavior. Your, look in the mirror, your behavior. Why else would those funds create a minus 11% return? You know, It's very frustrating. I'm sorry, but okay. Back to the story here, Mike. You know, the least satisfying answer for the biggest risk right now is something coming out of left field. You know, those biggest risks are always the ones you don't see coming, and by definition, there's no way to plan for them. I mean, they aren't. You know, I could come up with some variables like interest rates and or the Fed goofing up or something. But the way I see it, any of the economic or market risks are the price of admission when you invest. I mean, you still see, because even when these people are making crazy, and traders, policymakers, politicians, whatever, look at the chart from 27 to now. It trends up. No one ever knows the timing or the amount of recessions or bear markets, but they will happen. And those risks are always present, even if they don't happen very often. So I'm back to what I was alluding to a minute ago. The biggest risk for most investors has nothing to do with the economy or markets at all. It's you. There's a risk that you'll abandon your strategy and make a big mistake at the wrong time. There's a risk that the fear of missing out, which you're seeing a bunch of right now with these quote-unquote AI stocks, will cause you to follow others into an investment you don't understand. There's a risk you become too complacent when markets are going up and too scared when markets are going down. There's also a risk that you'll sell all your shares and never get back in because you become paralyzed with fear of making another mistimed decision. You know, risk comes in different forms at different times, but never completely disappears, regardless of how you position your portfolio. A few closing comments. You know, I talked earlier about all the dividend income thing. I want to talk a little bit about this current interest in fixed income stuff that's come as a result of what the Fed has done with the interest rates. Now, when the yields on money funds and high-yield savings accounts are apparently the object of a number of people's focus right now because they're at relatively higher rates, higher than where they were, say, 5-8 years ago. Now, Bankrate says that their $25,000 investment in some money market funds today can give you an average return of 4.48%. However, the fine print says the national average is just 0.47%. Further, money market funds float with interest rates in most instances, so there's no way to guarantee your return over however long you've got the money in there. You just know you'll get something while it's parked. Now, there's recently been a tsunami of articles recently highlighting the options, quote-unquote, that folks have. There was one popular piece called Four Ways to Lock in Yields Above 5%. That was in last Wednesday's journal, Wall Street Journal. And I get the appeal for some, but seeing the world this way is a potentially major personal financial mistake. Let me try to give you what I'm why I say that. According to Reuters, U.S. investors were big buyers of money market funds in the 7 days leading up to February 28th. That was when the PCE inflation report was released. Those investors, they're not investors, they're savers. They purchased a net $42.5 billion worth of money market funds during the week. That's the largest weekly net purchases so far this year. That's from LSEG. And on the other hand, stock-related funds received inflows of $196 million during the week, with growth funds taking in $613 million. There's a little bit of difference in those numbers, wouldn't you agree? Let me see here. The not good news was that just the week before, stock funds had about $4.8 billion taken out. The growth funds had $3.5 billion taken out. Compounding that injury was that U.S. short and intermediate investment grade funds took in $2.5 billion. That was the biggest amount in 3 weeks. The longer dated bond funds stayed in demand for a 10th successive week. They took in $1.8 billion. And now all this while stocks are setting new highs. Why invest in something? Never mind. We haven't got time for that. One of the many things wrong with this in general is that those folks must have tunnel vision. That's all there is to it in my mind. They see investments as primarily a function of yield only. As in, I have this chunk of money. It's earning X. And if the Fed cuts rates, I need to make sure this pile of money keeps earning X no matter what. Now, the concept of total return is something that they have never been exposed to, I wouldn't guess. Now, the issue is this. Yield is actually compensation for risk. So, an investment that boasts a high yield after Fed rate cuts and falling money market yields is probably going to take more risk than either cash or cash equivalents. Flipping from money market funds and traditional savings accounts into higher yielding choices ignores all that. Those unsophisticated investors face a high likelihood of exposing their savings cushions to unwanted and misunderstood risks. Here's some of the vehicles in the journal's piece that they suggest as, again, alternatives. One is a certain type of deferred annuity that offers CD-like yields for longer maturities. Now, the article notes that these products are illiquid, and if you have to get up early, you have to get out early, you'll have to give up 5-8% of the total value. Now, why would someone hold cash that you need on a near-term basis in something like that? Need a new roof, or here's the house we wanted to buy. The last thing you want to do is pay a chunk of money just to get access to your money in the first place. So if you don't need the liquidity, the decision to lock in today's yields could amount to missing a lot of return and compound growth in stocks or even a blended portfolio. Your opportunity cost can be huge in the long run. Now, other suggested alternatives in the article were bond ETFs, exchange-traded funds, preferred stock, and a certain type of corporate bonds. Now, all are debatable on their merits, at least as far as in lieu of cash. They're not, it's not that they're bad unto themselves, it's just where are you using them? The larger issue is that each is subject to short-term volatility, primarily driven by the direction of interest rates. So you lose stability that comes with cash. Again, counter to the idea of why you're holding it. Now, those bond-like investments are more in the realm of treasury and traditional corporate bond securities and funds. So that makes them part of the fixed income conversation, not the cash conversation, which means that they relate to entirely different sets of potential risks. Some bond funds use leverage, which can magnify volatility and compounding the mismatch. But I'm convinced that articles like this encourage investors to view cash incorrectly, as if it's a return engine. No, it's more similar to a parking place for your cash. That's it. No more, no less. That's what money market funds are for. They're not an investment. Anybody who thinks of it as an investment is really a saver, in my opinion. The whole purpose of interest paid on cash and cash equivalents is to help you offset inflation's long-term erosion of your buying power. It's to help reduce risk, not to add to returns. If you flip to a return mindset and lose sight of the purpose for your money, then you can risk ending up in an illiquid, volatile investments that aren't really a good fit for your needs. And if the goal is always returns, well, cash was a terrible way to do that, even at relatively high yields, because the high opportunity costs involved, again, not to mention the inflation risk and taxation. Now, this is a big reason why we always suggest against chasing yield. High yields that exceed money market funds and treasuries, well, there'll always be compensation for volatility, illiquidity, fault risk, or some other combination like that. So please don't let the attraction of an easy, quote-unquote, so much return on your money lead you astray. Always keep the focus on your goals, your needs, and your time horizon first and foremost, not some advertised yield, okay? It's not to your benefit. So let's see here. Well, we got just a little bit of time, you know, close things up. January 3rd, 2022, there was a 13-year, sevenfold rise from the financial crisis low on March of 2009. The S&P topped out then at 47.96. January 19th, 2 years and a few days later, it passed that level and closed at new high ground. And again, we're at new high ground as of yesterday, even much above 48.39. But in between those two dates, the age-old tragedy continued, even with the stock market making new highs. The particular strategy isn't directly related to or caused by the stock market. The tragedy is in the way people reacted to those drops and have always reacted to it. Simply stated, it's selling out your core holding stock investments in fear, only to see them rise to new heights later, as indeed they have always done. Peter Lynch. He was the best stock picker ever. Look it up. Fidelity Magellan Fund. He said, more money has been lost preparing for a correction than in any correction ever. Meanwhile, at least so far, no recession. The economies continue to grow. Job creation quite brisk. About 4 million jobs added just since the market low of October of 22. Inflation still, it's coming down nowhere near to where it was before the bug. But and despite higher prices, retail sales have continued fairly strong. So I hope all of this has proved helpful to you. There's a lot of things going on. We'll do our best to keep up on it for you in our weekly broadcast. And of course, as I must say, especially today, go Zags, reduce those gales to their lowest molecular state. I thank you very much for listening, folks. I hope you have a great, positive, and productive week. You've been listening to Money Management. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and we'll talk to you soon.
Join us again next week at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Mike Mayo, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Have a question, comment, or want to find out if you'd be a good fit with Opus 111? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investment involves risk and is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.